content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the September 18th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. European Union opens doors to immigrants. What happened? European Union leaders this week proposed a sweeping plan to deal with the continent's escalating migrant crisis, including quotas for member states to divide up the latest wave of 160,000 asylum seekers. At least 350,000 migrants have flowed across Europe's borders this year, many fleeing violence in Syria, Iraq, and across the Middle East, as well as in sub-Saharan Africa. Almost 3,000 people have perished en route, a tragedy crystallized for the world last week in the wrenching image of Syrian toddler Aylan Kurdi lying on the Turkish beach, drowned when a smuggler's boat capsized in the Mediterranean. In response to the worst refugee emergency since World War II, European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker announced action requiring that the new asylum seekers be distributed among the EU's 28 nations. Quotas for each country would be binding. "It has to be done," Juncker said, "and it will be done." Several Eastern European countries vehemently opposed mandatory quotas, however, arguing that they will entice more people to make the risky journey across land and sea to Europe. The Obama administration, meanwhile, is rethinking its own asylum policies, which limit the number of migrants from Syria to 1,500 a year. But many lawmakers oppose allowing more people from the Middle East to settle in the U.S. "Terrorists have exploited the refugee process to sneak into our country," said House Homeland Security Committee Chairman Michael McCaul, Republican from Texas. What the editorial said: "This is what the world looks like when the West abandons its responsibility to maintain world order," said the Wall Street Journal. As the Syrian civil war against Bashar al-Assad enters its fifth horrific year, more than 200,000 Syrians have been killed and millions displaced. ISIS and other Islamic terrorist groups have sprung up in the chaos, but President Obama and our European allies have chosen to do almost nothing. Now we're seeing the consequences. Intervening is risky, but so is abdication. What happens in Damascus doesn't stay in Damascus. As Europe struggles to cope with the tide of migrants, blame reverberates across the continent, said the Chicago Tribune. Critics say the borders are too porous, or that some countries aren't doing their fair share. But we Americans shouldn't be quick to judge. Germany and other European countries have been absorbing refugees for years, but the influx has placed vast demands on social welfare states. With millions more sure to flee, how can Europe reasonably be expected to take? What the columnist said: "Many of the recent migrants aren't fleeing war-torn Syria," said Jonah Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times. "They're middle-class Syrians fleeing places such as Turkey, Jordan, and Hungary, where they've already found safety. What they didn't find was a pleasant place to live or raise kids. So they headed for Germany and Sweden, where the standard of living is much higher." After seeing images of welcome parties for migrants at German train stations, Iraqis are now packing their bags too. "I'm sympathetic to their plight, but where will this end?" The sight of Aylan Kurdi's lifeless three-year-old body inspired a wave of Western soul-searching, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times, with much talk about how the world failed him. But what does that mean exactly? As we've seen in Libya and Iraq, U.S. military intervention doesn't always end well. Our Iraq misadventure, in fact, helped destabilize the entire region. There are limits to what the U.S. can do in that fractured, chaotic part of the world, a cold reality unchanged by the image of a tiny body on the beach. Still, America can and must do more for the migrants, said Julia Yaffe in foreignpolicy.com. I'm living proof why. I was seven in 1990 when my family came to the U.S. as Jewish refugees from the Soviet Union and started a free and prosperous life. But the fight to get Soviet Jews into this country took the kind of political will that's sorely lacking in 2015. Now all we hear is talk of bureaucratic bottlenecks or congressional gridlock. But American presidents in the past have issued executive orders to overcome such obstacles. If Obama has a bucket list, why isn't this on it? Controversy of the week. Kim Davis, a martyr for religious freedom. So this is what religious liberty looks like, said Sean Illing in Salon.com. 2 months after the U.S. Supreme Court made same-sex marriage the law of the land, Christian conservatives finally have their martyr, County Clerk Kim Davis of Kentucky, an apostolic Christian who insists she can refuse to issue marriage licenses to gay couples based on God's authority. After a Republican federal judge briefly jailed her for contempt of court, the weeping Davis was released this week and was greeted by thousands of cheering supporters, while a sound system blasted Eye of the Tiger. This modern-day St. Thomas More, incidentally, married 4 times and gave birth to 2 kids out of wedlock before deciding to impose her biblical morality on others. Legally, Davis hasn't got a leg to stand on, said Megan McArdle in BloombergView.com. As a public official who made a vow to uphold the laws of the U.S. and Kentucky, Davis has no right to refuse to do her job, any more than pacifists have a right to become military officers, or Christian Scientists have a right to become dean of Harvard Medical School. If she wants to follow her religious conscience, then she should resign. Resigning would be an unacceptable surrender, said David French in NationalReview.com. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy and the court's 4 liberal justices fired the first revolutionary shot in June by rewriting the Constitution in favor of gay marriage, defying legislative and voter-passed gay marriage bans in dozens of states. By refusing to let her office issue licenses to same-sex couples, Davis is simply answering revolution with revolution and giving America's Christian citizens a stirring example of peaceful resistance of judicial tyranny. Liberals who clamor for the rule of law suffer from a glaring double standard, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. President Obama has repeatedly taken unconstitutional executive action on immigration and climate change. And in 2004, San Francisco's mayor gave marriage licenses to 3,200 gay couples in defiance of state law. These liberals were lionized by those now holding up an obscure Kentucky clerk as a national villain. But if government officials can cite their religious faith as justification for defying the law, said Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in Time.com, the result will be total chaos. Can Christian court clerks now refuse to marry divorced people too, because Jesus spoke against divorce? Should an Orthodox Jewish motor vehicles clerk be allowed to deny driver's licenses to people who eat ham or drive on Saturday? No, but there should be an alternative to throwing Davis in jail, said Eugene Volok in WashingtonPost.com. Federal and Kentucky state laws oblige public and private employers to make reasonable accommodations for workers with religious objections if doing so doesn't cause a major disruption. Hospitals have allowed nurses morally opposed to abortion, for example, to opt out of any involvement in the procedure. Why couldn't something similar have been worked out for Davis? But Davis' position has become indefensible, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. Steered by crusading lawyers, the Kentucky clerk has indicated she might refuse even to let her deputies issue marriage licenses to gays. Such blind obstructionism actually does great harm to sincere religious people seeking reasonable exemptions from secular society. We conservative Christians have to pick our battles carefully, said Rod Dreher in the AmericanConservative.com. Insisting that a county clerk can stop all same-sex marriage in her jurisdiction is not a viable position. Kim Davis is a bad martyr for the cause of religious liberty, and we conservative Christians will come to regret her stance. It was a good week for Queen Elizabeth II, who became the longest reigning monarch in British history, surpassing her great-grandmother, Queen Victoria's, record of 63 years and 216 days. The Queen, 89, said the distinction was not one to which I have ever aspired. It was a good week for high spirits after a Scottish distillery revealed that a test vial of its unmatured malt whiskey that had recently returned from the International Space Station contained a curious perfumed note and other flavor profiles not encountered here on Earth before. And it was a good week for getting a taller fence after a pair of bickering Florida neighbors asked a police officer to file a hurt feelings report because both women had called each other mean names. But it was a bad week for soft targets after some 30 incoming cadets suffered injuries, including concussions, split lips, and broken limbs, at West Point's annual morale-building pillow fight for freshmen. The cadets had stuffed their pillows with helmets and other hard objects. It was a bad week for innovative technology after a science teacher from the Academy of Innovative Technology in Brooklyn was arrested and charged with accidentally crashing his drone into an empty seating area in the middle of a U.S. Open tennis match. And it was a bad week for winning the military vote after Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump, who got a medical deferment from Vietnam War Service, told an interviewer that attending a high school military academy gave him more training militarily than a lot of the guys that go into the military. On the briefing page this week, the rise of Europe's far right. As a backlash against immigration grows, ultra-right parties are gaining adherents across Europe. How strong are they? What do these parties stand for? Far-right parties have been gaining across the EU for several years, as nations that were once nearly entirely white and Christian have absorbed large numbers of Muslim immigrants from the Middle East and North Africa. These parties are right-wing in a very European sense. They tend to be nationalistic, favoring promotion of Christian values and strict limits on immigration, but also support a strong welfare state for native Europeans. Their overarching theme is that the benefits of a country should go to the Europeans who were born there and pay taxes there, not to newcomers. In last year's elections to the European Parliament, the EU's legislative body, far-right parties gained enough seats to have their own bloc, which gives them access to EU funding. Led by Marine Le Pen of France's National Front, the group includes the Dutch Party of Freedom, Italy's Lega Nord, and the Austrian Freedom Party. Why now? Lots of economic and cultural insecurity. The Euro financial crisis involving Greece, Italy, Spain, and Portugal struck just as Europe was faced with a mass influx of people from the Middle East and Africa seeking asylum, as well as a movement from poorer EU countries to richer ones. Since the global economic crash of 2008, employment throughout the EU has jumped from under 7% to nearly 11%, and most countries cut benefits. Even in such traditionally tolerant and liberal countries as Sweden and Germany, many people began to feel their country was being asked to take foreigners while citizens were making do with less. Then, too, immigration has visibly changed some of Europe's oldest cities. Paris had to ban street praying because hundreds of men were spilling out of overcrowded mosques and setting up prayer rugs blocking streets and sidewalks. In Malmö, Sweden, where just half of the population is ethnic Swedish, crime has soared as rival immigrant gangs battle one another and police. How has Sweden reacted? Sweden long prided itself on its generous asylum policy, welcoming twice as many refugees per capita as any other Western country. In 2014, for example, the country of 9.5 million took in more than 85,000 people, mostly Muslims from Syria, Iraq, and Somalia. But the new arrivals' failure to assimilate has sent voters stampeding to the right. The Sweden Democrats, a once reviled party with roots in neo-Nazism, took 13% of the vote in last year's election to become the third biggest party in parliament, mostly on a campaign to halt immigration. Over the summer, as the flood of refugees pouring into Europe dominated headlines, the popularity of the Sweden Democrats soared, and now they are the most popular party in Sweden, with more than 25% support. What about Germany? Germany is a special case because there the nationalistic far right has been practically outlawed since the end of World War II. With no outlet in mainstream politics, anti-immigrant fervor erupted last October as a street movement in Dresden. For 4 months, the Patriotic Europeans Against Islamization of the West, or PEGIDA, organized weekly mass demonstrations calling for strict control on Muslim immigration. Now the Alternative for Germany, a small anti-EU party, has begun reaching out to PEGIDA supporters, promising to fight immigration and promote more children for German families. Where else is the far right strong? It's well established in France. Le Pen has managed to purge the National Front of the overtly anti-Semitic tone set by her father, party founder Jean-Marie Le Pen. Now the National Front is considered mainstream, taking 25% of the vote in local elections this year. Polls show that Le Pen may be one of just two candidates to make into the second round of the 2017 presidential elections, amid rising anti-immigrant sentiment. In Denmark, meanwhile, the far right is now part of the government. The Danish People's Party soared to second place in the June elections amid public disgust over a shooting rampage in Copenhagen in which the son of a Palestinian immigrant killed two people and wounded five. Already it has slashed benefits for migrants in half and begun taking out ads in Lebanese newspapers, warning asylum seekers not to come to Denmark. Nowhere, though, is the right stronger than in Hungary. what's happening in Hungary. The neo-fascist Jobbik Party, which advocates ethnic purity for Hungary, took 20% of the vote last year to become the third biggest party in parliament. Its influence has pushed the right-wing ruling party, Fidesz, even further rightward. Hungary has built a razor wire fence along its border with Serbia in an attempt to keep out migrants, and President Viktor Orban said the EU should not accept people who have a radically different culture and religion. It is not worrying in itself that European Christianity is now barely able to keep Europe Christian, he said. We have no option but to defend our borders. Thanking Mama Merkel. While the far right has gained strength, it still represents a minority of Europeans. Many Europeans, in fact, are appalled by the rise of these parties and have staged large demonstrations in support of their immigrant populations. After vandals threw firebombs at several Swedish mosques this year, Swedes responded with love bombs, covering mosque doors with paper hearts and notes of support. In Iceland last week, after the government said it would accept just 50 Syrian refugees, more than 15,000 Icelanders volunteered to sponsor refugee families in their own homes. In stadiums across Germany, soccer fans have been hanging banners saying, "Welcome refugees." Chancellor Angela Merkel has made a point of saying Germany has a responsibility to accept refugees from brutal civil war in Syria, and some Syrians are calling her Mama Merkel and Compassionate Mother. "German people deserve to be thanked," said Syrian refugee Monis Bukhari, who arrived in Berlin 2 years ago and already has a German passport. "They showed us so much sympathy." Moving on to the columns now, we'll take two from the U.S. The first, Behind the Myth of Reagan. When Republican candidates gather for their second debate at Ronald Reagan Presidential Library on September 16th, said Timothy Egan, they will pay fulsome tribute to the patriot saint of all true conservatives. But the GOP has moved so far to the right since Reagan's presidency that today he would never be allowed on stage. The real Reagan, not the mythic one, granted amnesty to nearly 3 million illegal immigrants, vastly increased the size of the federal government, raised taxes at least four times, and nearly tripled the national debt. On abortion, Reagan mouthed the pro-life line as president, but as governor of California, he signed a legislation bill that enabled abortions in his state to rise from 500 a year to nearly a million. Having been shot himself, he advocated sensible firearms legislation, supporting both the Brady Bill and an assault weapons ban. He supplied money and arms to the Afghan rebel group that would grow into the Taliban. In defiance of Congress, Reagan secretly sold arms to Iran's mullahs and was the commander-in-chief when 248 Marines were killed by terrorists in Lebanon, a debacle that makes Benghazi look like a game of pinochle. By today's standards, Reagan was a conservative heretic. Pope Francis' revolutionary leadership. With another breathtaking act of compassion, Pope Francis is transforming the Catholic Church, said Lisa Miller. The Pope last week announced that Catholic women who've had abortions can go directly to any priest, confess, and receive forgiveness for what the Church considers one of its gravest sins. Remarkably, the Pope said he understood the unmanageable real-life circumstances that have led so many Catholic women to this agonizing and painful decision, and wanted them to receive the Church's mercy if they truly repented. As he did when he said about gay people Who am I to judge? Francis made no change in doctrine. The church still considers abortion and homosexual acts sins, but he's reversing the censorious orthodoxy of his predecessors and reopening the church's doors to all Catholics, no matter what sins they've committed. To Francis, Christian compassion is everything and extends to everybody. This is truly a revolutionary pope, and he's remaking a rigid institution once defined by its hostility to change into a far more fluid, forgiving, understanding, and ultimately modern church. This is an international column. Middle East. Rich Arab nations snub refugees. The plight of Syrian refugees is shameful for every Arab, said Abdel Mohsen Yusuf Jamal in Al-Kabas from Kuwait. Syria's neighbors, Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon, have already taken in some 4 million people and can accept no more. So now hundreds of thousands of Syrians are taking the dangerous journey across the Mediterranean and through Europe to reach Germany, which has generously promised them shelter. Meanwhile, much closer and easier to reach Arab nations, including Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, Oman, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates, have accepted zero refugees. This is a region of nearly unimaginable wealth, with the world's tallest buildings and most lavish palaces. It has no shortage of jobs, given that it imports almost all of its private workforce. Yet these rich Arabs seem not to care about the deaths of refugee children, as if Islam meant nothing on the Arabian Peninsula. But Syrians don't want to go to Saudi Arabia, said Elhanan Miller in timesofisrael.com. Saudi's society is much more closed and conservative than Syria's, and Syrians know they'd be treated as third-class citizens there. From 2011 to 2014, Germany and Sweden each received some 50,000 asylum requests, while Saudi Arabia had a grand total of 12 Syrian applications. Of course, part of the reason the Persian Gulf countries don't get asylum seekers is that they haven't signed the United Nations 1951 Refugee Convention, which obliges countries to provide protection for refugees. Saudi Arabia and other Gulf nations are afraid that if they start allowing asylum claims, their cheap foreign labor force, made up of desperate people from unstable countries like Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Egypt, would apply en masse. Yet Gulf states have taken refugees in the past, said Sultan Saud al-Qasimi in ibtimes.co.uk. After Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, the Emirates and other Gulf countries took in hundreds of thousands of Kuwaitis, giving them entire apartment blocks in Abu Dhabi and elsewhere. So why are Gulf governments so reluctant now? The Arab Spring has scared them. They fear that the educated, westernized Syrians could stir up their traditionally politically passive societies. Too bad. With great power comes great responsibility. Gulf Arabs have the wealth and space, and they have a moral duty to open their doors. Extremists are already exploiting the failure of Gulf Arab governments to look after fellow Muslims, says Afzal Ashraf in AlJazeera.com. On social media, Islamist groups are pointing to the lack of action as further evidence of Arab rulers' apostasy and disdain for the faithful, arguing that an Islamic revolution is needed in the Gulf to guarantee Muslims' welfare. Saudi Arabia and other countries would do well to prove these extremists wrong, to demonstrate superior moral and political leadership. Do they really want to cede the moral high ground to dangerous radicals? Thank you. in-depth article this week, the Last Word column, is titled, He Knows Just How You Feel. Dr. Joel Salinas experiences other people's sensations, said Erica Hayasaki. It's both a blessing and a curse. No one, it seemed, knew what the patient clutching the stuffed blue bunny was feeling. At 33, he looked like a bewildered boy staring at the doctors who crowded into his room in Massachusetts General Hospital. Lumpy, oyster-sized growth shrouded his face, the result of a genetic condition that causes benign tumors to develop on the skin, in the brain, and on organs, hindering the patient's ability to walk, talk, and feel normally. He looked like he was grimacing in pain, but his mother explained that her son Josh did not have a clear threshold for pain or other sensations. If Josh felt any discomfort at all, he was nearly incapable of expressing it. Any numbness? Asked Joel Salinas, a soft-spoken doctor in the Harvard Neurology Residency Program. Like it feels funny? Josh did not answer. Salinas pulled up a blanket, revealing Josh's atrophied legs. He thumped Josh's left leg with a reflex hammer. Again, Josh barely reacted. But Salinas felt something. The thump against Josh's left knee registered on Salinas' own left knee as a tingly tap. Not just a thought of what the thump might feel like, but a distinct physical sensation. That's because Salinas himself has a rare medical condition, one that stands in marked contrast to his patients. While Josh appears unresponsive even to his own sensations, Salinas is peculiarly attuned to the sensations of others. If he sees someone slapped across the cheek, Salinas feels a hint of the slap against his own cheek. A pinch on a stranger's right arm might become a tickle on his own. If a person is touched, I feel it, and then I recognize that it's touch, said Salinas. The condition is called mirror touch synesthesia, and it has aroused significant interest among neuroscientists in recent years because it appears to be an extreme form of a basic human trait. In all of us, mirror neurons in the premotor cortex and other areas of the brain activate when we watch someone else's behaviors and actions. Our brains map the regions of the body where we see someone else caressed, jabbed, or whacked, and they mimic just a shade of that feeling on the same spots of our own bodies. For mirror touch synesthetes like Salinas, that mental simulacrum is so strong that it crosses a threshold into near tactile sensation, sometimes indistinguishable from the synesthete's own. Neuroscientists regard the condition as a state of heightened empathic ability. This might sound like a superpower of sorts, a mystical connection between one person's subjective experience and another's. But to be clear, Salinas cannot read minds. He doesn't know whether Josh felt the impact of the reflex hammer, and the tingling in his own kneecap says more about his own extraordinary nervous system than it does about that of his patient. What's more, for those who experience mirror touch synesthesia, an estimated 1.6% of the general population, the condition is often more debilitating than it is empowering. Mirror touch synesthetes struggle with a constant intrusion of others' feelings. At a symposium on mirror touch synesthesia last year in London, a woman named Fiona Torrance of Liverpool described how she had once seen one man punch another. She promptly passed out. I felt the punch, she explained. To this day, she takes medication to control the sensory onslaught. A recent episode of the NPR program Invisibilia profiled another woman with the condition who has essentially become a shut-in. Salinas, then, is a remarkable case in a couple of ways. As a neurologist, not only is he far better equipped than most people to understand the peculiarities of his own brain, but he also exposes himself daily to immense doses of other people's pain and discomfort. His patients suffer from strokes, spinal cord injuries, and a myriad of other disorders and injuries. Some are also depressed, anxious, or in extreme pain. When Salinas performs a spinal tap on a patient, he can feel the needle going into his lower back. When a psychotic patient goes into a rage, Salinas feels himself getting worked up. When a patient dies, Salinas feels an involuntary glimmer of the event firsthand. His body starts to feel vacant, empty, like a limp balloon, and then he moves on to the next patient. For centuries, scientists have known that some people's senses get crossed. Some of us hear words in colors. Others see music in bright bursts or glimmers. Studies have shown that about 4% of the population has some form of synesthesia, which tends to run in families. And if you have one form of synesthesia, it appears likely that you will have another as well. Salinas, for instance, also sees letters and numbers in colors, a condition known as grapheme color synesthesia. He also associates these colored characters with personality traits and feelings. For example, a certain person might feel like a five, which to Salinas is a red-orange color that he associates with pride and self-interest. People with strong fours and sevens are cool and grayish-blue, sky blue with Russian blue, very soothing. Mirror touch synesthetes vary in how intensely they register feelings of others. Some report feeling sensations of pain more viscerally, and even claim to feel temperatures vicariously. Others describe feeling another person's pain as a mere trickle, tingle, or twinge. Salinas experiences other people's sensations of injury and intense emotion, but only to a muted, partial degree. If he saw someone being stabbed in the arm, he says, he would not feel the sharpness of the blade, but rather an echo of pain on his own arm. While other types of synesthesia have been studied for ages, scientists have only been studying mirror touch synesthesia for a little over a decade. Researchers have found that subjects with mirror touch synesthesia recognize the facial emotions of others better than people without the condition. They've also found that mirror touch synesthetes tend to have greater volume of gray matter in areas of the brain linked to social cognition and empathy, and less brain volume in the temporoparietal junction, which plays a key role in distinguishing self from others. There is still a huge amount to be learned about the condition, and the specific mechanisms behind mirror touch synesthesia remain somewhat mysterious. Outside a tiny world of researchers, the condition is so little known and sounds so otherworldly that it is still often met with skepticism, which is why, for Salinas, coming out as someone with synesthesia has felt similar to coming out as gay. You never know who is going to be open to it. It's not something you easily bring up in conversation. Salinas was born in Miami to a pair of political refugees from Nicaragua. As an emotionally precocious and hypersensitive child, Salinas avoided the sensory overstimulation of sports and running around with packs of kids. He preferred to read alone or sit with adults. He remembers being fascinated by their faces, their reactions. Sometimes he engaged in self-soothing behaviors, like flapping his arms. People probably thought I was autistic, Salinas says. But in high school's morass of angst-ridden teenagers, Salinas was forced to learn how to regulate his own emotional responses. He learned whom to stay away from, how to calm his own mind, how to let sensations pass, skills that he would come to master and rely upon as a physician. The key was learning to direct his attention. Salinas' ability to achieve a kind of serenity in the middle of chaos was fortified during his time as a medical student and resident, especially when he worked in the emergency room. It would take all of Salinas' strength to stay professional as he treated car crash victims, informed distraught families that their loved ones were brain dead, and most vividly, treated a man whose arm had been ripped off by a train. To calm himself, he would take deep breaths and focus on the calmest person in the room. Surprisingly enough, it wasn't until the summer after his first year in medical school that Salinas realized his condition was unusual and that it had a name. During a medical trip to India, he heard a friend with a neuroscience PhD talking about people who experience colors and sound as sound. Salinas pulled him aside afterwards and asked, "Isn't that everybody?" Salinas had always figured that others saw the world the way he did, in colors and feelings. "I just figured it was like being human," he said. There are many ways in which mirror touch synesthesia probably makes Salinas a better doctor. In recent years, there has been a lot of talk in medical circles about the decline of doctors' observational powers. As more and more diagnostic work is done by machines, the fear is that physicians are becoming worse at paying close attention to patients with their own eyes and ears. Some hospitals have even taken to offering doctors modified classes in art appreciation in an attempt to revive their atrophying skills of pattern recognition and awareness. Salinas' condition arguably makes him unusually gifted at these tasks. Empathy itself is another quality that modern doctors are said to lack in sufficient doses. Here, too, Salinas' mirror touch synesthesia gives him advantages, particularly his heightened facility for reading people's facial expressions and emotional states. On the day I shadowed him at Massachusetts General Hospital, an HIV patient with a fungal infection in her brain lay in bed, screaming, hacking, and vomiting. She had fluid backing up in her lungs. The nurse in charge was visibly stressed. The family stood nearby looking terrified. Salinas felt the nurse's anxiety and the family's distress. As he later described to me, he could feel the patient's constricted chest, his own chest rising and falling with hers. When she took a turn for the worse and was intubated, Salinas said, he felt the tightening of his vocal cords as if being intubated himself. Yet, as I watched him manage the emergency, he never seemed ruffled. At 7 p.m., the end of his shift, Salinas removed his white doctor's coat and replaced it with a heavy black parka with a fuzzy hood. I followed alongside as he made his way to an elevator, stepped out into a crowded main lobby, and then into the bustling Boston streets, filled with commuters. I asked what it felt like for him to move through the throng of people. Could he describe it to me moment by moment? When the elevator doors opened, a man on a knee scooter, his left leg folded up beneath him on the seat, had rolled in after us. Salinas told me he'd felt his own leg folded beneath him at the knee. He began to point out people around him. A woman with a phone pressed against the right part of her face. He felt the hardness of the phone. A woman rushing down a set of stairs, her bobbing hair in a bun, a few strands against her face. He felt the wispiness. His descriptions came rapid fire as the crowd swelled. Feelings, gestures, movements, facial expressions. So many people passing by so fast that I wouldn't have paid the slightest attention to them on my own. A husky man in a corridor wearing a knit hat. I felt the heaviness of the knit hat on my head. A woman sitting at a table on a balcony, tapping her fingers together. Salinas felt the fingers touch. Another woman at the bottom of the escalator, legs crossed. He felt the tangle of legs. In hearing his stream of descriptions, I could almost understand what Salinas meant when he described the daily bombardment of ambient feelings as a kind of white noise. It's as if Salinas feels everything and nothing at the same time. By necessity, he keeps himself remarkably detached from all the errant sensations that tug at his attention. He would probably lose his sense of self if he didn't. And the most surprising thing about him, once you know all this, is that being in his presence is calming. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Pacific Standard. On the obituaries page, the clean-cut Disney star who found faith, Dean Jones, 1931 to 2015. Dean Jones could always hold his own against scene-stealing co-stars, especially those of the non-human variety. As the leading man in a string of hugely successful Disney movies in the 1960s, Jones specialized in playing the befuddled but affable foil to preternaturally intelligent animals, including a cat, that darn cat, a dog, the ugly Dachshund, and chimps, monkeys go home. But his best-known role was as a down-on-his-luck race car driver, Jim Douglas, in The Love Bug, opposite a Volkswagen Beetle with a mind of its own. I think if I had had a big thought, that probably it would have ended the string at Disney, Jones said later. But it didn't. Every film was a success. Born in Decatur, Alabama, to a railway worker and his wife, Jones briefly dropped out of high school at 15 to sing at a New Orleans nightclub, said the Los Angeles Times. But when the club closed, he returned to school in Decatur, where he hosted his own radio show. After a post-graduation stint in the Navy, Jones landed a contract with the MGM film studio and was cast in small roles of a far grittier nature than his later Disney fare, playing drug addicts, pimps, and killers. He made his Broadway debut in 1960 with Jane Fonda in the flop There Was a Little Girl, followed by the hit comedy Under the Yum-Yum Tree. Not long after, Walt Disney himself came calling. But as Jones became more famous, his wholesome image on screen and his real life became increasingly disconnected, said The Guardian. He began womanizing and drinking heavily and suffered from depression. I had the Ferraris and beautiful women and all the rest of what I thought would satisfy my life, Jones recalled in 1997, and it was empty, really empty. In 1973, Jones had what he called a religious awakening after a night of drunken stunt driving, said the New York Times. He became a born-again Christian and later founded the Christian Rescue Committee, a support group for persecuted Christians and Jews. Though he continued to appear in films and on stage, his faith influenced many of his professional choices. "I won't blaspheme God," he said in 2009. That immediately eliminates most scripts. On the health and science page now, more trees than anyone dreamed. The world's tree population stands at over 3 trillion. A groundbreaking new study has found, dwarfing the previous estimate of 400 billion. Earlier tree counting research relied exclusively on satellite imagery, but the ambitious new census also used extensive ground survey data, including national forest inventories and peer-reviewed studies in which workers physically went out and counted trees. Researchers analyzed information from more than 400,000 forest plots in 50 countries. Filling in the gaps in unexamined areas with estimates based on tree density trends in similar regions. Lead author Thomas Crowther of Yale University cautioned that the higher number wasn't necessarily good news. "It's not like we've discovered a load of new trees," he tells BBC.com. In fact, study estimates that the number of the trees on Earth has fallen by 46% since the dawn of human civilization. Tree cutting, land clearing, wildfires, and pest outbreaks are reducing the net number of trees by about $10 billion a year, researchers say. The implications for climate change are profound. Trees extract carbon dioxide from the atmosphere as they grow while emitting oxygen. But cutting and burning them releases the carbon dioxide, and the fewer trees there are, the less atmospheric carbon is trapped. "We can say now that there are fewer trees than at any point in human civilization," Crowther says. "We've reduced the number by almost half, which is an astronomical thing." The Grand Canyon contaminated. The 250-mile stretch of the Colorado River that winds through the Grand Canyon is one of the most isolated places in the United States, and by all appearances should be one of the most unspoiled. But a new study reveals that the river's vital ecosystem is dangerously contaminated. Researchers from the U.S. Geological Survey found toxic levels of mercury and selenium in green algae, fish, insects, and snails. Heavy metals harmful to wildlife preying on those creatures, and ultimately to humans. Pristine really doesn't exist in the world anymore, even at the most remote reaches of the Grand Canyon, lead author David Walters tells National Geographic. The contamination comes from a range of sources, near and far. Farms release tons of selenium-rich soil into the Colorado River every year, and abandoned gold mines leach heavy metals into lakes and streams. Mercury emissions from coal-burning power plants as far away as China can waft for thousands of miles before settling in rivers and lakes and accumulating in algae and other water life. Those heavy metals become more concentrated and dangerous as they travel up food chains. Mercury poisoning can disrupt the central nervous system in animals and people. Selenium, which can cause birth defects in fish, is also associated with human health issues like hair and tooth loss. Geophysicist Roger Clark said the study shows that what we do outside the Grand Canyon can and does adversely affect what's living in the canyon. On the Talking Points page, Speaking Spanish, Bush's Bilingual Campaign. When Donald Trump last week attacked rival Jeb Bush for speaking Spanish, said Andres Oppenheimer in MiamiHerald.com, it was, to use one of Trump's favorite words, stupid. The bilingual Bush, who is married to a Mexican immigrant, has responded in Spanish when taking questions from a Spanish-speaking Miami audience, saying of Trump, "El hombre no es conservador," the man is no conservative. Anti-immigration zealot Trump shot back that the former Florida governor should not set an example, or the former governor should set an example by speaking English while in the United States. Fellow GOP hopeful Carly Fiorina chimed in erroneously that English is the nation's official language, and Sarah Palin exhorted us all to speak American. But Americans should actually be speaking more Spanish and other languages as well if we want to remain competitive in a global economy. In Europe, India, and China, speaking a second and third language is commonplace. Actually, Trump has a point, said Ed Straker in AmericanThinker.com. So many people are now speaking Spanish in this country and listening to Spanish language media that we're in danger of losing our national language. When Mexicans call up a company in Mexico, do they have to press 1 for Spanish? A new study by the Los Angeles School District confirms that bilingual education has failed, noting that students who take classes in Spanish are more likely to quit school and remain locked out of the mainstream. The only way for immigrants to assimilate is through immersion classes in English. Immigrants do need to learn our language, said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post, but it's utterly ridiculous to suggest English must be spoken at all times. Even Trump knows better. A 2014 job posting for one of his hotels said a bilingual applicant was preferred. I'm bilingual myself and speak Spanish almost daily, which allows me to enjoy warm relationships with countless new Americans. Trump is simply trying to negate one of Bush's great strengths. He can speak directly to Hispanic voters who are crucial to winning the presidency. That's especially true in Bush's home state of Florida, said Peter Greer in the Christian Science Monitor. It's almost impossible for the GOP to win the presidency without that critical swing state's 29 electoral votes. And to win Florida, Republicans need about 40% of the Hispanic vote. They won't get it with Trumpism. And wrapping things up with a few shorts. Gasoline prices have hit their lowest levels in 11 years. The national average for regular gasoline is at $2.42 a gallon, 9 cents lower than last week, and $1.01 lower than last year. 66% of Americans give Pope Francis a favorable or very favorable rating, including 80% of U.S. Catholics. 70% of Catholics think the church is moving in the right direction. And a quote to finish up from comedian Jim Gaffigan. Most of the time, I feel entirely unqualified to be a parent. I call those times being awake. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments, give us a call, 919-832-5138.